They seemed to be hair in the sheets. Jamie insisted he could only sleep if Bovril was tucked up with him, and Bovril, drat him, seemed to feel the same way. It snowed again. When I rode Butter over to Maggie's, snow balled up under his feet and clumped in the bottom of his tail. The whole world was white and sparkling. Snow in London didn't stay white for long. Maggie had been helping Fred every day since she'd come home, and on the days when I was there, we all worked together. Fred had started me properly jumping now. Little jumps, but not today, because the snow was too deep. "You know you're supposed to get Susan a Christmas present," Maggie said, as we measured oats in the feed room. "Why?" I asked. I'd heard about presents. I didn't get them. I didn't need to give them. I said so. Maggie rolled her eyes at me. "Of course you'll be getting presents," she said. "Susan is nice to you, not like some." I nodded. Some of the evacuees, those that were left, weren't treated very kindly. Not because of anything to do with them, but because they'd been put with mean old hags who wouldn't have welcomed Jesus himself. At least that's what Jamie said. He talked to the other evacuees at school, and they were envious, they were, that they hadn't been chosen last. "So," Maggie said, "you should get her something. It's only right." "I haven't got any money. Not any at all." "Don't you get pocket money?" "No. Do you?" "Oh," Maggie said. She chewed her bottom lip while she thought. "Well, you could find some job to do and earn something, I suppose. Or you could make her something. She'd like that. My mum always likes it when I make her something." It was an interesting idea. I thought about it as I started home. Susan had been teaching me to knit, so that I could knit for the soldiers, but so far the only thing I'd made had been a washcloth. It was a hideous washcloth, wider on one end than the other, with loopy stitches that looked nothing like Susan's. Susan claimed it didn't matter, because soldiers would be glad to have a washcloth, no matter what it looked like. She also said knitting was like writing, or riding, or anything else. You got better the more you worked at it. I could work at it, if I hurried. I turned Butter in the road, and despite his protests, made him go back through the snow to Maggie's house. Fred looked surprised to see me.
"Trouble?" he asked.
"I need some wool," I said. Chapter 30
"Aye," Fred said, nodding, as though girls rode to him through snowstorms all the time, needing wool. He disappeared into the stables, and I heard him clop up the stairs to the rooms in the loft where he lived. He came down carrying a cloth bag printed in bright flowers.
"It's the missus's knitting bag," he said, thrusting it at me. "It's full of wool, all sorts. You can have it."
I didn't know he had a missus.
"Aye," he said, in response to my unspoken question. "She's been dead 5 years. Was nurse to Miss Margaret and Master Jonathan, and before that to their mother and her brothers."
I squashed the bulky bag beneath my jacket to keep it out of the snow. Butter tossed his head, restless, and I let him turn for home.
"Wait." Fred grabbed Butter's bridle. "When someone gives you a present," he said, with a gentle smile, "you say, 'Thank you.'"
Susan had taught me that, but I'd been so busy thinking about the wool the bag contained that I'd forgotten.
"Thank you, Fred," I said. "Thank you very much. I wish I could say thank you to your missus, too."
"Oh, well," he shook his head. "Happen she'd be glad I found her things a good home. You're very welcome, child."
It was Thursday already, and Christmas was Monday, so I didn't have much time. When I got home, I dumped the bag onto my bed. There were 5 sets of knitting needles, from thick to thin, and a handful of smaller thin sticks that were pointed on both ends. There were all sorts of oddments of wool, rolled into balls, and there were 6 balls of fine white wool. The white wool would be best. I had plenty of it. I cast on and started to work. I expected Susan to be suspicious when I spent the whole afternoon in my cold bedroom, and she was. "What are you up to?" she asked at dinner. I ran through my options in my head. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't taking a bath. I couldn't be listening to the radio. Stalling while I searched for a plausible excuse, I said, "Nothing." To my surprise, she grinned. "Oh, really? I'll make a bargain with you. You can have a few hours of nothing time upstairs any time the rest of this week you like, as long as you give me the same amount of nothing time downstairs. You shout before you come down, and wait until I tell you okay. Deal?" I could only nod. In the days to come, I could sometimes hear the whir of her sewing machine while I knit upstairs. I took a hot water bottle with me and put a blanket around my shoulders, and I knit white wool and oddments all the next 2 days. Wretched Bovril started wanting to sit in my lap on top of the water bottle, until I threw him out and shut the door. The day before Christmas was a Sunday. When Jamie and I got up, we dressed in the clothes Susan insisted we save for Sundays. Jamie in his white shirt and tweed shorts and good dark socks. Me in the red dress Maggie had given me. We went down to breakfast, and Susan shook her head. "Sorry, forgot. Go put your regular things on for the day. We're going to church at night. All of us. Even me. It's Christmas Eve." Because it was Christmas Eve, we had bacon at breakfast. During the day, I helped make biscuits. Jamie roasted chestnuts for the goose's dressing. Susan put the radio on and sang along to the Christmas music. Mid-afternoon, she made us bathe. She brushed my hair downstairs by the fire until it was dry, and braided it in 2 plaits instead of 1. We ate supper, and then she told Jamie to go upstairs and put on his church clothes. She told me to sit still. "I have a surprise." She put a big box wrapped in paper onto my lap. Inside was a dress made of soft, dark green fabric. It had puff sleeves and a round collar, and it gathered at the waist before billowing out into a long, full skirt. It was so beautiful, I couldn't touch it. I just stared. "Come," Susan said, "let's see if it fits." I held perfectly still while she took off my sweater and blouse and settled the green dress over my head. "Step out of your skirt," Susan said, and I did. She buttoned the dress and stepped back. "There," she said, smiling, her eyes soft and warm. "It's perfect. Ada, you're beautiful." She was lying. She was lying, and I couldn't bear it. I heard Mam's voice shrieking in my head. "You ugly piece of rubbish, filth and trash. No one wants you with that ugly foot." My hands started to shake. Rubbish, filth, trash. I could wear Maggie's discards or plain clothes from the shops, but not this, not this beautiful dress. I could listen to Susan say she never wanted children all day long. I couldn't bear to hear her call me beautiful. "What's the matter?" Susan asked, perplexed. "It's a Christmas present. I made it for you. Bottle green velvet, just like I said." "Bottle green velvet." "I can't wear this," I said. I pulled at the bodice, fumbling for the buttons. "I can't wear it. I can't." "Ada." Susan grabbed my hands. She pulled me to the sofa and set me down hard beside her, still restraining me. "Ada, what would you say to Jamie if I gave him something nice and he said he couldn't have it? Think, what would you say?
Tears were running down my face now. I started to panic. I fought Susan's grasp.
I'm not Jamie, I said. I'm different. I've got the ugly foot. I'm...
My throat closed over the word rubbish.
Ada, Ada!
I felt I could hardly hear Susan's voice. A scream built up from somewhere inside me came roaring out in an ocean of sound. Scream after scream. Jamie running half-dressed down the stairs. Susan pinning down my arms, holding me against her, holding me tight. Waves of panic hit me over and over, turning me and tossing me, until I thought I'd drown.
Chapter 31
We didn't go to church. We ended up on the floor in front of the fire, wrapped in blankets Jamie dragged down the stairs. All of us. I don't know how long I screamed and flailed. I don't know how long Susan restrained me. I kicked her and scratched her, and probably would have bitten her. But she held on. I don't know what Jamie did, other than bring down the blankets. Susan wrapped me in one, rolled me up tight, and the panic started to ease.
That's it, Susan croaked. Shh. Shh. You're okay.
I was not okay. I would never be okay. But I was too exhausted to scream any more. When I woke, the first rays of winter sunlight were coming through the window onto the little Christmas tree. The coal embers shone dully beneath a layer of ashes. Jamie slept wrapped in a blanket, with Bovril's face peeping out beneath his chin. Susan snored gently. One of her arms was flung up under her ear. The other still rested across me. Her hair had come out of its bun and was sticking out in all directions. She had a long red furrow down one cheek from where I'd scratched her, and her blouse, her best blouse, had a rip at the shoulder and a button hanging by a thread. She looked like she'd been in a war. I was so completely wound in a grey blanket that I could only move my head. I turned it from side to side, looking first at Jamie, then at Susan, then at the little Christmas tree. Susan would be angry when she woke. She would be furious because I'd screamed about the dress, because I hadn't been grateful, because I'd messed up her plans. We hadn't gone to church because of me. My stomach worked itself into a knot. She would be angry. She would hit... No. She wouldn't hit me. She hadn't. At least not so far. She hadn't hit me once the night before, not even when I'd hurt her. She'd wrapped me up and held me tight. I didn't know what to do. Susan was temporary. My foot was permanent. I lay in the weak sunshine and wanted to weep instead of scream. But I almost never cried.
What was wrong with me now?
Jamie stirred. He opened his eyes and... smiled. Smiled his beautiful smile. All of my life I would remember the sweetness of that smile.
Good morning, Ada, Jamie said. Merry Christmas.
I didn't know what Susan had said or done to Jamie before he fell asleep, but he woke as though sleeping on the living room floor was perfectly ordinary. He sat up, rubbed Bovril's belly, then put the cat outside to do his business, and added coal to the fire. The rattle of the coal scuttle woke Susan. I watched her carefully as she opened her eyes and came to an awareness of where she was. She saw me, and she smiled too.
Smiled.
Good morning, Ada, she said. Merry Christmas. I wanted to bury my head in my blankets and weep and scream, but I didn't. Instead I said, I can't get up. I can't move my arms. She sat up and untangled me. I wasn't trying to trap you, she said.
It seemed to soothe you, to be bundled like that.
I know, I said. It did.
I pointed to the rip on her blouse.
It's in a seam, she said. I can fix it.
She brushed my loose hair back from my face. Would you like some breakfast? We got up and went upstairs and washed our faces and used the loo. At Susan's suggestion, we took off our good clothes and put on our pajamas and dressing gowns. When we came back down the stairs, there was a pile of brightly wrapped packages under the tree. Presents.
Looks like Santa Claus has been here, Susan said gaily.
Seemed odd that Santa Claus would stay away all night but come while we were changing our clothes. I opened my mouth to say so, but saw Jamie's glowing face in time and shut up fast. Jamie's eyes were lit with joy.
He really did come to us. He did, he said, even though Ada was bad.
He gave me a quick, guilty look.
I mean...
It's okay, I said, slipping my arm around his shoulders. I was bad. I wondered if the presents were all for Jamie.
Could any possibly be for me?
Not bad, Susan said. She helped me down the last few steps. Not bad, Ada. Sad? Angry? Frightened? Not bad. Sad, angry, frightened, were bad. It was not okay to be any of those. I couldn't say so, though, not on that gentle morning. I had the gifts I'd made stuffed into the pockets of my dressing gown. I didn't have any paper to wrap them. I wasn't sure what to do.
Breakfast, Susan said.
She put the kettle on for tea and started a pan full of sizzling sausages. She fried us each an egg. On the table, laid across our plates, were two of our stockings, one each. They were stuffed full and knobbly. I poked mine.
You should have hung those up last night, she said, but I see Santa found them anyway. Have a look inside while I finish cooking.
An orange, a handful of walnuts, boiled sweets, two long hair ribbons, one green and one blue. In the toe, a shilling. Jamie had the same, except he had a whistle instead of hair ribbons, and an India rubber ball. Shiny bright girls, with ribbons in their hair. I wanted to weep all over again. I wanted to scream. What was wrong with me? I couldn't mess up Jamie's Christmas. I stroked the satin ribbons and went away in my head. I was on butter, up on the hill, galloping, galloping. Ada, Susan touched my shoulder. Come back. Fried sausages on my plate. A fried egg, its yolk as bright as the sun. Toast and strong hot tea. Jamie blew his whistle, a piercing shriek.
Save that for outside, Susan said, ruffling his hair.
After breakfast, we opened our presents. Jamie got a toy motor car and a set of building blocks. I got a new halter for butter, and a pad of paper and a set of coloured pencils. We each got a book. Mine was called Alice in Wonderland. Jamie's was Peter Pan. Susan didn't get anything from Santa Claus. She told Jamie grown-ups didn't. But I pulled my gifts from my pocket. For Jamie, I had a scarf made of all the oddments of yarn, different colours and kinds and stripes. He looked at it and frowned.
I like the scarf Susan made me better, he said.
Susan poked him, and he said,
Thank you,
which kept me from smacking him. Then I gave Susan her scarf, knit from the white wool. I made hers last of all my gifts, so it would be the best, because I really did get better at knitting the more I did it. Susan unfolded it against her knee.
Ada, it's beautiful. This is what you've been doing?
I got the wool from Fred, I said quickly, so she'd know I hadn't stolen it. She hugged me. I love it, I'll wear it every day. I shrugged her away. It was too much, all this emotion. I wanted to get away. She seemed to understand even that. Put your jods on and run out to see your pony, she said. Jamie'll help me clear up, and we'll get started on dinner. Jamie's three pilots came mid-afternoon. They wore their best uniforms and identical polite smiles. They gave Susan a bottle of wine, a box of chocolates, and a potted plant. Susan told them she felt like she was getting the gifts of the Magi, and they laughed. The house smelled like roast goose. The fireplace crackled. The sun was setting already, and the living room looked warm and bright, even with the blackouts up. The pilots sat awkwardly on the sofa, all in a row. But then Jamie started cutting up, running his new car over their knees and grinning and acting silly. And pretty soon one of the pilots was on the floor playing with Jamie, making towers with the building blocks and smashing into them with the car. And Susan gave the other two pilots glasses of wine, and everyone seemed much more relaxed. I wasn't relaxed. I was wearing the green dress. I'd put it on when I came in from seeing Butter, because I knew it would please Susan. And it did. She brushed my hair and let it hang loose, tying my new green ribbon around my head. "That's an Alice ribbon," she said. "The girl in your book, Alice, she wears her hair like that." I felt like an imposter. It was worse than when I tried to talk like Maggie. Here I was, looking like Maggie. Looking like a shiny, bright girl with hair ribbons. Looking like a girl with a family that loved her. Jamie squeezed my arm.
"You look nice," he whispered, scanning my face anxiously.
I took a deep breath. I did have family that loved me. Jamie loved me. Susan called us to dinner. She'd put Christmas crackers by everyone's plate. I'd never seen them before. They were tubes of paper. When you pulled the ends apart, they made a cracking noise, and paper crowns and little toys fell out of them. We all wore our paper crowns to dinner. The pilots and Susan and Jamie laughed and talked, and I ate goose and tried to keep my inside still. "That's a pretty dress," one of the pilots said to me. I felt prickly all over, like my skin was too tight for my body. But I wasn't going to let myself lose control again. "Thank you," I said. "It's new." It was kind of him to mention my dress instead of my bad foot. I told myself that over and over and kept still. When they left, Susan sat me on the sofa beside her. "That was hard for you," she said. I nodded. She pulled me against her, tight, the way she had the night before, except that I wasn't screaming. "Put the radio on, Jamie," she said. "Ada, let's see to your foot." I sighed and arranged myself on the sofa, my bad foot in her lap. She pulled off my stocking and started rubbing and twisting it, the way she did every night. "We were," she said, "making a very small bit of progress."
"Where's our book?"
Jamie said, and went to fetch it. We were halfway through reading Swiss Family Robinson for the second time. I understood the story better now, but I still didn't like it. The family landed on the perfect island, where everything they needed was right in front of them. Susan pointed out that they had to work together to put the good things to use. Jamie just liked the adventures.
"Not that," I said. "Read mine."
I made Jamie fetch Alice in Wonderland. Between Alice's hair ribbon and the word Wonderland, I doubted I'd like it. But it was better than More Family Robinson. It was better. Alice chased after a rabbit who was wearing clothes and a pocket watch. He went down his hole just like the rabbits I saw when I was out on Butter. But she went after him and fell into a place she didn't belong, a place where absolutely nothing made sense to her.
It was us, I thought. Jamie and me.
We had fallen down a rabbit hole, fallen into Susan's house, and nothing made sense. Not at all. Not anymore.
Chapter 32. In January, rationing began. It was a way of sharing out what food there was so that rich people, like Susan, couldn't go hogging it and leaving poor people to starve. Rationing meant there might not be any butter or meat in the shops, and if there was, you'd better get in the queue for it fast before it sold out. We all had ration books that said how much food we were allowed. It made Jamie nervous. Me too. Susan had always given us plenty of food, but we knew that was because she was rich, no matter what she said. I'd gotten used to eating regular. We tried eating less. The first time Jamie asked to be excused before he finished his dinner, Susan felt his forehead. "Are you sick?" she asked. He shook his head. "Then eat. I know you can't be full."
"I'll save it for tomorrow," he said.
I pushed my plate away.
"Me too."
Susan told us firmly that we were not to save our dinners. She said rationing meant we would have to eat different kinds of food. More vegetables, less meat, less butter, and sweets. It did not mean there would not be enough food. There would always be enough food. She would personally see that we always had enough to eat.
"Even if you have to get a job?" I asked her.
"Yes," she said firmly. "Even if I have to char." Chars were the lowliest kind of cleaning lady. Some of the older girls on our lane back home were chars.
"Why?"
I asked. She looked at me, blank.
"Why? You didn't want us. You don't even like us."
Jamie held perfectly still. Susan sipped her tea, the way she always did when she was stalling. "Of course I like you," she said. "Don't I act as though I like you?" I shrugged. "I never wanted children," she continued, "because you can't have children without being married, and I never wanted to be married. When I shared this home with Becky, that was the happiest I had ever been. I wouldn't have traded that for anything, not even children. I was so sad the day you came. But it wasn't about you. I was just sad. I didn't think I could take good care of you. I didn't think I could take care of any children."
"And you didn't want to,"
I said, "especially us." Susan said, "Ada, what's this about, really? The better you get, the worse you seem." I shrugged again. It was scary how angry I felt inside. At Susan for being temporary. At Mam for not caring about us. At Fred for wearing the scarf I had knit him from his wife's wall every day, as though it was something special, when I could see myself how I'd dropped some stitches and picked up others, so that the scarf was full of holes. At Maggie for loaning me her copy of Alice's Adventures Through the Looking Glass when I told her how much I liked Alice in Wonderland, as though books were something you could just give out like yesterday's newspapers, as though I would be able to sit down and read it as easily as she would, as though the letter I sent her when she went back to school, which took me hours and was full of scratches and misspellings, was anything at all like her letter back to me, written in ink with the curvy handwriting. At the war, for taking us away from Mam before she realized she loved us. At myself, for being so glad to go.
Ada?
Susan spoke slowly and clearly.
Right now, you are here. I am not sending you or Jamie anywhere. You will both stay here. I will take care of you. You will have enough to eat. You are learning to read and write, and next year you will go to school. We will get your mother's permission, and as soon as we do, we will get the operation to fix your foot.
All will be well.
Relax.
When she started to speak, I almost went away, to the place in my head where I didn't feel anything. But Susan tapped my arm, keeping me with her, and she put her hand lightly around my wrist while she spoke. I pulled my hand away, but I stayed where I could hear her. That's how I heard the words, "An operation to fix your foot."
Fix my foot? What on earth did she mean?
3 days later, I rode Butter to the top of the hill. I halted where we could see the sea, dark and violent and thrashing, where the wind whipped Butter's mane against my bad foot, held as it was by the crook of the side saddle. The wind blew the wisps of hair around my face and made tears come to my eyes, and I could feel its coldness even through my warm coat and hat and mittens. No boats anywhere. No signs of spies. New towers built near the beach, and more barbed wire, and what looked like soldiers marching along the ocean's edge. Our soldiers. If it were the Germans invading, the church bells would have rung. I rode slowly down the hill, through the village. The butcher standing in his shop door nodded his head to me. One of the women I passed smiled. Another waved. They saw me ride by every day. If they thought I should be kept locked up, at least they didn't say so. They didn't look disgusted by me. At home, I untapped Butter and rubbed him dry. I fed him and combed out his tangled mane. I cleaned the saddle and bridle and put them neatly away. I took my time. Then I went into the house where Susan was, and asked, "What does the word operation mean?" Chapter 33. Susan took me back to see Dr. Graham so he could explain. He did not re-examine my foot. We sat in his office, all three of us, and he talked, and I listened.
"First of all," he said, "understand that we can't proceed without your mother's permission. At this point, it would have to be considered elective surgery, and that's why we've been waiting for her approval." He glanced up at Susan. "You haven't gotten it?" She shook her head. "Well, I have been reading up on the procedure," Dr. Graham said. "It wouldn't be me who would do the surgery. We'd have to send you to a specialist. I've written to one that I think would be best. He does say that you won't ever have a normal foot. Please understand that. You could have, if treatment had started early enough. But you can't now. You won't get a normally functioning ankle. But we could hope for a foot that looked normally positioned, that you could walk on with the plantar surface down." He looked at me and added, "That means the bottom. What should be the bottom of your foot would be the part touching the ground."
I thought about this. "Would it hurt?" I asked.
"You would be sleeping during the surgery," he said. "We would give you special medicine to make you stay asleep, and you wouldn't feel anything then. Afterward, yes, it would probably hurt. You'd need to stay in hospital for quite a long time, too, probably several months. Your foot would be kept in plaster casts."
"Would I be able to wear shoes?"
His eyes smiled, even though his mouth did not.
"Yes," he said, "when everything was healed, you would."
I thought of something else. "Who pays for it?" I asked. "It cost a pile of money to stay in hospital."
Susan and the doctor exchanged glances.
"We'll deal with that problem when we come to it," Dr. Graham said. "I'm sure there are charities we could get involved."
Susan and I walked home silently through the blustery, freezing wind.
"What are you thinking?" she finally asked. "He said if I'd started treatment early, I could have had a normal foot."
"Yes," Susan said. "Most babies born with club feet have them fixed right away.
All the way fixed?
Susan put her hand on my shoulder. Yes, all the way. I could have always lived outside the one room. I could have been like Jamie, running fast. I said,
I thought you kept writing to Mam because you wanted to get rid of us.
Susan said, no wonder you were angry.
I felt fragile, not the way I had when I'd exploded on Christmas Eve, but the way I'd felt the next morning, when the only thing that kept me together was Jamie's smile. Jamie's and Susan's smiles.
At home I sat at the table while Susan put the kettle on. Do you want to go ride? She asked. I shook my head. I drank the tea she put in front of me. I pulled my plait over my shoulder and studied the blue ribbon at the end of it. Then I pulled off the slipper shoe Susan had made and pulled off my stocking and looked at my foot. The awkward U-shaped ankle, the tiny toes that curled up, not down, the rough calluses where my skin had torn open and then healed, over and over again. Susan said, it's not your fault. I said,
I always thought it was. I thought I'd done something wrong.
I know, Susan said.
It's disgusting, I said.
Susan said, I never thought so.
I searched her face to see if it was a lie. She looked at me steadily. She said,
if you feel very angry, go outside and throw something. I didn't feel angry. I felt sad. So sad, I could get lost in the sadness.
But when I finished my tea, I got out paper and a pencil, and in my very best handwriting, wrote a letter. Dear Mam, it said, please let them fix me. Chapter 34. I waited for a reply. Twice a day the postman dropped letters through the slot on the front door. Twice a day I went to look. Susan said it would take at least 2 days for the letter to get to London, and 2 days for an answer to come back to us. But 10 days passed, and still there was nothing.
I bet they aren't delivering letters in London, Jamie said, because of the war.
I could tell by the look on Susan's face she didn't think that was true. On the 12th day, a letter I recognized fell at my feet. My own. Return to sender was scrawled across it. No longer at this address.
She's moved, Susan said, turning the unopened envelope over in her hands. She lives somewhere else now.
Susan said perhaps Mam had a new job and had moved to be closer to it. She said perhaps the government had requisitioned our flat. She said there were a number of reasons that Mam might have moved that didn't mean she'd abandoned us, and she, Susan, would make inquiries through the WVS. Someone in London was bound to know where Mam had gone.
What happens to us? Jamie asked, wide-eyed.
You stay with me, Susan said, just like you do now. Your Mam knows where you are. She knows you're safe.
What happens when the war's over?
Susan took a deep breath. Your Mam will come and get you.
What if she doesn't? Jamie insisted.
Don't worry, Susan said. I'll make sure someone always takes care of you.
I'll take care of him, I said, suddenly furious. I took care of him before, not Mam. I hated...
Oh. Even in my head, I still couldn't say I hated Mam.
Even now.
If I could get my foot fixed,
maybe she'd be different.
Maybe she'd love me. Maybe she would. You did a good job taking care of Jamie, Susan said. But it was a big job, and you shouldn't have had to do it. So now you can relax. I can take care of you. You don't have to fight so hard.
She couldn't take care of me. She talked about fixing my foot, but she couldn't do it. Not really. It was all just lies. And I wanted my foot fixed so badly. I was tired of it hurting. I wanted to be like a normal person. I wanted to walk without crutches, and I wanted to go to school, and I wanted to wear shoes on both feet. I never wanted to be locked up again.
I hated crying, but I couldn't help it. I sat on the sofa and sobbed. Susan held me to her.
I know, she said. I'm so sorry. I know.
She stroked my hair.
If it was emergency surgery, she said, if you broke your leg, or if your life was in danger, I could give permission for that. But this is a big operation, and it is elective. You can survive without it.
I can't give permission. I've asked the WVS, and I've consulted a lawyer, and without your mam's permission, we can't have it done.
I'm so sorry. We'll keep looking for her. We'll find her.
I don't want to just survive, I said.
I know, Susan said. So you'll have to figure out how to make that happen, without fixing your foot.
It's hard, she said. But that's the truth.
The winter turned fierce. Snow drifted over the fields and made it impossible for Butter to climb our hill. Even the ride to Fred's was so wretchedly cold, I dreaded it. I went every day now, for afternoon feed, because the winter work was too much for Fred. He didn't watch me ride. It was far too cold for that. I put Butter in a stall and did chores with Fred as fast as possible, and then rode home. Water froze in the troughs. The horses ate mountains of hay.
"It's getting to be too much for you," Susan said, when I came home with my toes and fingers numb, shivering so hard I couldn't stop.
"If Fred can't manage, Lady Thornton will have to hire someone to help him, war or no war."
"It's not too much for me," I said. "I promise."
Susan insisted I would attend the village school next year. She borrowed all sorts of books from the town library and made me read them. If I couldn't read a word, I was supposed to ask her what it meant. The more I read, the less I had to ask. She started me on math and history, too. Our days went like this. Susan woke us in the dark and cold. We washed up and dressed as quickly as we could. Downstairs, Jamie tended the fire in the living room, while Susan worked the range. I went out to give Butter hay. After breakfast, Jamie washed the dishes by himself, while Susan and I took the blackouts down. Then we had housework, reading, and sewing. Jamie played with Bovril on the rug. Lunch, school for Jamie, shopping for Susan, me helping Fred. More chores, then dinner. Susan would read out loud while she massaged my bad foot, and then we went to sleep under the mountain of blankets Susan had piled on our bed. Susan looked horrified when the first chilblains appeared on my bad foot. I shrugged.
"I always get them," I said.
She shook her head at me and consulted Fred. He found a piece of stout leather meant for tack repair, and together he and Susan designed a sort of boot. I stepped my bad foot into it and buttoned it up the side. It was loose, so I could wear extra stockings, and Fred oiled it until it stayed dry even in wet, mushy snow. That kept the chilblains from getting worse. They didn't heal, however, which distressed Susan.
"I don't know why," I said. "They're not bad."
"They must hurt," she said. I shrugged. "They did. And the itching sometimes kept me awake nights. But I couldn't do anything about it."
"My foot always hurts," I said. "I always get chilblains in winter." Usually I got them on my hands as well.
Next winter, Susan said, we'll stop them before they get started. There must be some way.
I looked at her.
Will I be here next winter?
She said. It's starting to look that way. The wall's not going anywhere. She bought goose grease in the village and rubbed it on my soles.
Stephen's colonel invited me for tea again, and this time I went. The winter was so bleak, I was glad to have something different to do. And anyway, I wasn't as afraid of things as I had been. The colonel wore several cardigans layered over his waistcoat, even though his parlour was warm. He presided very grandly over a tea table set with scones and small ham sandwiches.
"My dear," he said happily, "we've saved up our butter ration for you."
They had. They had a whole little dish of butter along with jam for the scones.
"Thank you," I said.
"Take plenty," he urged.
I took a tiny sliver.
"More than that," he ordered, as though he could see me.
I laughed. Stephen said, "She's got loads, don't worry." And after that, it was easy to relax and eat.
Stephen said there was a new poster up by the train station. It showed Hitler listening to some British people's conversation. "Careless talk costs lives," Stephen quoted. "That's what it says on the newsreels." Susan had taken us to see the film The Wizard of Oz, but she'd let me stay in the lobby during the newsreel. I said, "Jamie worries about spies, but I don't know if they're really real. The government's so full of talk. How many spies do you think there are?"
"Hundreds," the colonel said. "They're everywhere. It was spies that sunk the Royal Oak. How else could a submarine have gotten into Scarpa Flow?"
I knew that was what people said.
"Yes, but..."
"You think we don't have spies right now in occupied France? In Germany itself? Of course we do. Stands to reason they'd have sent spies here."
I told him how I always looked out from the top of the hill, from where I could see such a long way. He nodded.
"You keep a lookout everywhere," he said. "I tell Stephen, pay attention to everything. You never know. One word in German, one false move."
Stephen, grinning, helped me to another scone. I grinned back. Posters or newsreels, or spies notwithstanding, it was hard to sit in a warm parlour with snow falling outside and really believe in the war. But by the end of January, German U-boats had sunk 56 ships in that month alone. Most were cargo ships trying to bring food and supplies to England. In February, the Germans sunk another 51. The shops looked sparse, coal supplies ran low, and the weather bore down on us like a cold, heavy weight. We went to bed earlier and slept later in the mornings, just to avoid the black misery, until, finally, the days began to brighten.
Chapter 35. Maggie came home briefly at Easter. She was shocked by how much work I was doing, and also by the state the stables and house were in. Her house, not Susan's.
"I've told Mum we've got to shut up most of the rooms," she said.
I'd learned that Maggie was 12 years old, top of her form in her current school, though she'd moved to a different school for older girls next year.
"Trying to keep on as we always have without enough staff is pointless, and Grimes must have help, or he'll drop over dead."
"It's not that you're not wonderful," she added, cutting off my protests.
"But it's ridiculous. You'll drop dead too. She's still paying a gardener. He can help Grimes, and we'll turn the park into crops. We're supposed to be doing that anyhow."
I nodded. Susan had hired the vicar's gang of boys to dig up most of what was left of our back garden and cut out the bushes in the front. We were planning a big victory garden,
potatoes and turnips and carrots, Brussels sprouts and peas. Susan had already planted lettuce seeds on the dirt covering the roof of our shelter. Jamie was agitating for chickens, since eggs were getting scarce. "Most of the evacuees in town are gone," Maggie added. "Mum said so. It makes her feel she hasn't done her job properly."
"Do you think you'll leave?"
I shook my head. "Or Mum thinks we're safer here." I'd written to Maggie several times over the winter, but not once had I been able to tell her about Mum's disappearance. I didn't want Maggie to see me as rubbish, easy to throw away. "Friday's my birthday party," I added. "Will you come to tea? We're going to pretend I'm turning 11. Maggie already knew about my real birthday and my pretend birthday, but she still looked startled.
"I thought you were 11 already," she said. "You seem older than 10, even though you're small."
This pleased me.
"Really? Maybe you should tell Susan. Maybe we should pretend I'm 12.
Maggie ignored this.
"I'll be glad to come to the party. Home's dreadful, you can't imagine. I've never liked school, but now home's worse. Mum's in a funk all the time."
Every time I saw Lady Thornton, she seemed in constant motion, making lists, chivying volunteers, commanding the WVS. When I said so, Maggie grimaced.
"Yes, that's her public face. In private, she sort of slumps, and everything about her goes slow and dull.
I didn't know she'd gotten like this. When she writes me letters, they come from her public side." Jonathan had finished his pilot's training, Maggie said. He had been sent to Stratford RAF base, which was north of London somewhere.
"Mum can't get past it," she said. "Her brothers died in World War I, all three of them, pilots."
I shuddered.
"Maybe Jonathan should have gone into infantry."
"That's what Dad said, but Jonathan's like my uncles were, dead keen on flying. He always wanted to, even before the war. Mum told him she absolutely forbade it, but he signed up anyway. He was 21, so she couldn't stop him."
"If he dies, Mum will die too," Maggie said. "She had two other boys after Jonathan, before me. All of them, all three, were named after my dead uncles, and then the other two died of typhoid when they were very small.
Then came me, a girl, therefore useless. Mum's been afraid of this war since the day Jonathan was born."
"I'll keep an eye on her," I said. "I'll write you if your mum gets worse.
If I can tell she's worse."
Maggie nodded gratefully. "You don't know what it's like, being away from home and being so afraid."
Then she gave me one of our long, serious looks.
"Or maybe you do."
"It's not really my birthday," I said, on the morning of my celebration tea.
"No," Susan agreed.
"I'm not really 11 yet, or maybe I'm already 11. If I thought about it, this made me angry, so I mostly didn't think about it."
"Those are the two choices," Susan agreed.
"I could be 14.
"Doubt it," Susan replied. "You'd probably have a bit of a bust if you were."
This made Jamie snort milk up his nose. I laughed too, and then I started to enjoy the day. Susan had put a cloth on the kitchen table, and wildflowers Jamie picked in a vase in the center. She had saved up enough sugar from our rations to make a little cake. We had meat paste sandwiches, cut very thin, and fresh radishes, and tiny spoonfuls of custard sauce over the slices of cake. Susan made me a new dress from one that had been Becky's. Bright blue, like the springtime sky. She gave me a book called The Wind in the Willows. It was an old book, the cover faded and worn. When I opened it, I saw her spidery handwriting on the flyleaf. Susan Smith. And then beneath that, in fresher ink, "To Ada,
With love. April 5th, 1940. With love.
It's one of my old books, Susan said, clearing her throat. I'm sorry, I couldn't find a fresh copy in the shops.
I looked up. I'd rather have this one, I said.
Maggie gave me a little carved wooden pony. It's silly, it came from our nursery, she said, but I saw it the other day and I thought it looked like butter.
It did look like butter. Butter in summer, sleek and trotting through the grassy fields.
That night, I put my new book on the shelf Susan had cleared for us in our bedroom. I put the pony on the windowsill so I could see him from the bed. I hung my dress in the wardrobe next to my other clothes.
I had so much. I felt so sad.
Early the next week, Hitler invaded Norway and Denmark. It felt like England had lost the battle, even though I'd never so much as heard of Norway or Denmark before. As spring continued, Germany took over Holland and Belgium as well. Winston Churchill became England's new Prime Minister. The war, which had begun to feel like memories of our flat in London, hazy and unreal, suddenly came into sharper focus. Susan had always listened to the news on the radio each evening, but now Jamie and I paid close attention too. There still weren't bombs, in London or anywhere else, but the Germans were much nearer to England than they had been. Everyone thought we would be invaded next. The Air Force built pillboxes around our airfield to defend it. The government gave us 7 rules. 1. Do not waste food. 2. Do not talk to strangers. 3. Keep all information to yourself. 4. Always listen to government instructions and carry them out. 5. Report anything suspicious to the police. 6. Do not spread rumors. 7. Lock away anything that might help the enemy if we are invaded.
Like what? Jamie asked. Guns?
Yes, guns, Susan said. Lady Thornton, for example. Her husband has a whole room full of guns for hunting game birds. She'll need to hide those away.
We haven't got anything here the enemy would want, Susan continued. We don't have anything dangerous or valuable.
You aren't to worry, she said. Even if the Germans do invade, they won't hurt children. They didn't hurt the children in Norway or Holland.
Somehow, this didn't make us feel better at all.
The rumor in the village was that Holland had been full of German spies sent in before the invasion to help it go smoothly. The spies were called Fifth Columnists. I didn't know why. Fresh posters went up on the wall by the station, reminding us that England too might be full of spies. Loose lips sink ships, the posters said. 26 ships had been sunk in March, 10 in April. It was fewer ships than earlier, because now fewer ships were trying to get through the German blockade. Jamie started wetting the bed again. Susan marched him over to the airfield to talk to some of the soldiers, thinking they would reassure him. Instead, the men told Jamie that of course there were spies in England. They told him that children were often better than adults at noticing things, and that he, Jamie, needed to act like a soldier and keep a good lookout. They told him to report back at once if he discovered anything unusual. I didn't think Susan expected the RAF to turn Jamie into a snoop. But anyway, he quit wetting the bed. The government asked all the men who weren't already in the army to become local defense volunteers. Stephen's colonel was angry that he couldn't join.
A man shouldn't be useless at a time like this, he fumed.
It's not your fault you can't see, I told him. We'd run into them at the library. Susan was picking out more books for me, and Stephen was looking for things to read to the colonel.
"What difference does that make?" he said. "I still hate feeling helpless. And the boy tried to join up, and they wouldn't have him either."